The following program is brought to you by Total Theater Online. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the staff or management of WGBB. You're listening to the station that serves your community, 1240 WGBB. And now it's time for Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Dave's Gone By, 90 minutes of comedy, talk radio, music, and more. Brought to you every week at this time by Total Theater and Performing Arts Insider Magazine on WGBB, AM 1240 Freeport, and AM 1240 WGBB.com. One of the oldest radio stations in the country. Started up in 1924 from a garage on Bedell Street. Moved around a bit since then. Right now it's in Babylon, although the antenna is still in Freeport. Now the station is going to be 80 years old in December, twice my age. I don't know, somehow that doesn't seem like enough. I still feel like a young guy, so like you shouldn't be able to double my age and find yourself back in the flapper era. I remember being in my early teens and hearing that Mozart died when he was 35 and thinking, well, he was relatively young, but did make it to a healthy middle age. And then I got a little older and had that big shock when John Lennon got shot, and he was just a little over 40, which, again, I understood that was still quite young, but it still seemed a long way away. Now, in two more months, I'll be the age he was. Which means I'm trying to look for role models who live to 90, 100 now, like Bob Hope, Hubie Blake, Katharine Hepburn. I mean, I don't feel middle-aged, per se. Emotionally, I'm 20 years younger than 40, and anybody who listens to this program would immediately concur. But chronologically, there's no avoiding that I may have already lived half or more than half of the years I'll be on this planet. It's one thing to be 25 years old and worry, oh, I could get hit by a car, there could be terrorism, I might get a rare cancer from eating salmon. But that's still different from knowing, statistically, that the average life expectancy for men in this country varies, depending on which chart you read, from 72 to 80. Which means even if I go the full 80, I hit the edge of that expectancy envelope. The day after I turn 40, which means this coming Saturday, my birthday is on Friday. That Saturday, it's all downhill. The slow, devastating slope towards death begins for me. And the race to the cliff of mortality that began with thinning hair when I was 30 and gray hairs when I was 35. I mean, it's going to be neck and neck with a grim reaper in a few years. And oddly enough, I'm not freaking. I think I was more worried about death in my teens than I've been in my 30s, and I'm not sure why. Maybe I already understand the natural slowing down process. Or maybe it was 9/11, showing that if you go into the wrong building at the wrong time, it's boom kaboom long before you're 90 years old sitting in a nursing home pooping your diaper. So, on Friday, I turn the big 4-0, and that's okay by me. No midlife crisis. I'm not buying a sports car. I can't afford to buy a sports car. I'm not getting a toupee. I'd sooner graft my pubes to the top of my head. And amazingly enough, my pubes haven't slowed down one bit. Not that you need to know this, but my pubic hairs tend to grow at a rate that far outpaces Audrey the Plant in Little Shop of Horrors. It's like a jungle all over my glandular regions, but the top of my friggin' head? Nothing. Thank you, God. Thank you for putting all the hair where I don't need it. It takes me longer to trim my armpits than my scalp at this point. I mean, I'm not totally bald yet. I'm still at that point where I can cut my hair really, really short to give the appearance of actual overall growth. But my bad luck, I'm also short. So everyone who's shorter than I am, and that's not many, but if they are shorter, they look up. And I look great. Looks like I've got a nice, neat marine haircut from that angle. Anybody my height or taller looks down, and, oh, he's a bald guy. I will bet you that every professional basketball player is bald as an egg, and just, you know, nobody knows because nobody's been able to see the tops of their heads. It's a scientific thing. I'll bet you can prove it. If they ever do a sky cam at Madison Square Garden, they probably have to use a glare shield, but nobody knows because they're all taller than the hoops. But Hey, I've been getting fallow in the follicles for nearly a decade, so it's not as if I turned 40 and suddenly, oh my god, what happened to my afro? So I'm not taking this opportunity to get middle-aged crazy and pick up teenage girls for threesomes in a hot tub because I don't know where to find 20-year-old girls at this point, and even if I did, I would never do such a thing and talk about it on the air while my wife is listening. But essentially, turning 40 feels no different from my turning 39 or 36 or 31. I'm not going to dwell on what has and hasn't happened in my career. I'm not going to ruminate and stew about the choices I've made to this point in my life. Thank God, things have been pretty good. So most of what I say is pretty mellow and grateful, all things considered. Besides, you folks didn't pay good money to sit there and listen to me whine and complain. In fact, you folks didn't pay any money at all. You're sitting there, on your big-boned American rumps, expecting me to entertain you, to make you laugh, to give you an interesting idea or two for free. Free on the radio and on the internet. 90 minutes of pure entertainment, minus commercials, and all you have to do is listen. That is just not fair. That's just not right. Hey, it's my birthday. You should entertain me. That's right. Every week I get on here and do all these segments. I play music, sing funny songs, make fun of the news, invite all these guests, and you're out there passively tuning in, having a chuckle at my own expense, I might add. Well, gosh darn, that's fine. 51 weeks a year. But Friday is my birthday, and I expect some payback. I'm going to count to four, and then I want you to be, like, wildly entertaining. Split my sides laughing. Put a lump in my throat. Give me a moment of amusement that I will never forget. Okay? You owe me. I have been doing this show for 61 weeks now. I need a break. Not the whole show. Just a minute or two. Thrill me with your ingenuity. And stand close enough to your radio so I can see you. Okay. Take this moment to get any props you need. Warm up your voice, do a couple of leg stretches. On a count of four, Dave gets entertained, okay? One, two, three, and four, you're on. Alrighty. Guys, you could do better than that. Come on. Let's really see what you got. Okay. And that's it, huh? That's the extent of it. Whoa, you guys suck. I mean, no offense, but I do this thing week after week, hour after hour. I'm not always David Letterman, but hey, at least I try. I mean, what the hell was that? You, in Belmore, doing the thing with the... Yeah, you, what was that? And you, the one singing Happy Birthday in Middle Island? I mean, thank you, but don't give up your day job. Or do give up your day job and just end it all. And now the two girls doing the stuff with the ice cubes and the whipped cream in Locust Valley? That has potential. Please call the station, and we can definitely discuss places this act can go. But the rest of you... Oh, my God, pathetic! But I guess that's why I'm on this end of the mic, and you're on that end. Well, actually, you're not on the other end of the microphone. That would be kind of sick. Unless you're one of those girls with the ice cubes, in which case, please be careful of shock. But no, I see now that my purpose, my reason for being here, the reason I'm on the air every Monday night, 6:30 to 8 p.m., is because I can do it. It's what I do. It seems easy, but not everybody can do it, and certainly nobody can do it quite the way I do it. And that's why it's called Dave's Gone By, and not You Gone By or Moisha Gone By. It's 'cause I'm Dave. Dave Lefkowitz, radio personality, journalist, humorist, and 40-year-old, almost. So this episode is called 40 Winks. Nope, I won't be sleepwalking through it, but I will be taking it lightly, savoring my elderliness. And I'll do it by playing a couple of songs that sort of show where my head is at. I'll also be doing the usual stuff. I've got a great News Gone By for you this week. Whole bunch of good stories, many of them rather macabre, appropriate for this turning point birthday. We'll have stories about Dr. Death, female terrorists, maimings, Zoloft, Starbucks, tacos, dancing dogs, and noisy roosters. Plus, we'll be playing a Mepham song once more that was in the news this week, so I thought I'd play it one more time. The brand new classic folk song, The Rectum of Edmund Fitzgerald, sung by yours truly. That's later in the broadcast on the News Gone By. Oh, and if you haven't already guessed, this program isn't all rays for every single member of every single family. I like to say that we're rated DGB 13. That's the Dave's Gone By equivalent of PG-13, which means we're vulgar and goofy and tasteless, but not quite FCC 21. Heck, they allowed Bono to say the F word, so we're home free here. I will say one four-letter word, however. It's a really bad one. Here it comes. Work. W-O-R-K. I mean, happy Martin Luther King Day. I hope you all had the day off. But also on this program, I will be talking for a little while about labor issues, wages, immigration, a whole bunch of stuff that I wanted to do last week, but we ran out of time because I had so much fun talking to Karen Grasley of Little House on the Prairie. She was really great. I want to thank her for making it such a good show. But this show will be just as good. The news going by, I go off about labor, I play some music by Judy Collins, Simon and Garfunkel, so without further ado, let's begin the 61st episode of Dave's Gone By, and we'll do that right after... Oh wait, this just in, we have a Super Bowl update. This is very exciting. Tampa Bay 20, Oakland Raiders 3. That's at halftime. Tampa Bay leading Oakland 20-3. That is not this year's Super Bowl, it's last year's. Our scores are so late-breaking, they've already broken, been fixed, and broke again. But that's what makes us different. Dave's Gone By takes pride in being the only radio show where you can get Super Bowl scores 1 week before the Super Bowl. And although we don't encourage gambling on this program, I do have to say that if you took Tampa Bay with the points, you're probably in good shape. Anyway, we'll keep you posted as the night goes on. We'll also keep you teased, flummoxed, tickled, and interested, which is more than you did for me. So the least you can do is stick around for the rest of the show. Dave's Gone By. Now till 8 o'clock, we'll be right back with me ranting about something right after this. By now, I hope you've all had a chance to try the Tandoor Grill Indian Restaurant in Rockville Center and its delicious appetizers and main courses of lamb, chicken, and fish. Now it's time to bring 300 of your friends, because downstairs they've opened the Bollywood Lounge, perfect for catering and parties. The Tandoor Grill, 222 Sunrise Highway in Rockville Center, 516-766-4440. See the Indialicious menu at TandoorGrill.com. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and AM 1240 WGBB.com. Time for a segment called Dave Goes Off. Off on a topic, off on a rant, off on a subject I feel strongly about. Now, 2 weeks ago on the News Gone By, I did a bit about Swingline Staples. You know, they had that big neon sign you used to pass on the Long Island Railroad going through Queens, Swingline Staples, owned by American Brands. Well, Swingline closed that Queens plant a decade ago to move to Mexico, because wages there are $1.27 an hour, as opposed to the $18 an hour Americans were being paid when Swingline was in Queens. Well, the news item was that Swingline and American Brands is now moving from Mexico to China, presumably because workers in China make less than the whopping $1.27 earned by those greedy Mexicans. My joke was that Swingline will eventually move back to America, but only when employees have to pay the company to work there. But it's not a joke, it's really getting scary out there. A few days ago, Levi Strauss, the blue jeans company, about as American as you can get, Levi's closed its last two sewing factories in the United States. They laid off 800 people at the two plants in San Antonio. Now, Levi's has been in trouble for a while, and they just couldn't afford the expense of paying $10 to $12 an hour wages for their factory workers. So now, all sewing for Levi's jeans will be done overseas. And I dare them to show commercials of cute American kids at barbecues or Western cowboys donning their dungarees and chaps to go herd cattle. And the administration was stunned that after all the good economic news of the past few months, only 1,000 American jobs, new jobs, were created in December. They're expecting 250,000. They got 1,000. But let's talk about jobs and salaries and hiring and the whole schmear for a little bit. Here's a story from the Associated Press on January 6th. I'll read excerpts and comment at the end. The title of it was U.S. Offers Tips on Cutting Overtime Costs by labor writer Leigh Strope. The $1.3 million low-wage workers, the Labor Department says, will be guaranteed overtime pay as part of new rule changes may not necessarily see any extra cash. The Labor Department is touting the $895 million in increased wages. It says those workers would be guaranteed, but at the same time, they're also suggesting ways employers can keep their labor costs from going up. Among the options, cut workers' hourly wages, add the overtime to equal the original salary, or raise salaries to a new threshold of $22,100, which makes them ineligible. The department says it's merely listing well-known choices available to employers, even under current law. We're not saying anybody should do any of this, said a spokesman. So why say it? Well, anyway, new overtime regulations were proposed in March because employers complained they were being saddled with costly lawsuits. Workers claimed they were unfairly being denied overtime. But the regulations themselves have stirred controversy over how many workers would be stripped of their right to overtime pay. The Democrats are seizing on this issue, of course, and a final rule is expected to be issued in March. The Act defines the types of jobs that qualify workers for time and a half if they work more than 40 hours a week. Overtime pay for the 1.3 million low-income workers has been a selling tool for the Bush administration. Again, I'm still reading from the AP article here. They're trying to ease concerns in Congress that millions of high-paid workers might become ineligible. But the Labor Department is also telling employers how to avoid paying more money to these newly eligible low-income workers. Quote, most employers affected by the proposed rule would be expected to choose the most cost-effective compensation adjustment method, the department said. Now, wow, there is newspeak for you. Cost-effective compensation adjustment method, or as Bob Marley put it, give your more to receive your less. Still, I'm back to reading from the AP article. The Labor Department says, for some companies, the financial impact of the new regulations could be near zero. Employers' cost-cutting options include adhering to a 40-hour work week, raising workers' salaries to a new $22,100 threshold, which makes them ineligible for overtime pay. By the way, if you're keeping score at home, $22,000 translates to $425 a week before taxes. The current threshold, though, right now is $8,060 per year. The department does say that a pay raise should not be used as a way to get around the overtime issue. Companies can also make payroll adjustments that result in virtually no or only a minimal increase in labor costs, unquote. What that means is workers' annual pay would be converted to an hourly rate. The rate would be lower, but with overtime added in to equal a former salary. Essentially, employees would be working more hours for the same pay. Now, the department, Labor Department, does not view the payroll adjustment as a pay cut. Rather, it allows the employer to maintain the pay at the current level with a new overtime requirement, says one architect of the plan. Well, guess who criticized the plan? Labor unions, duh. Mark Wilson, a lawyer who specializes in overtime issues, said the Bush administration was protecting the interests of employers at the expense of workers. He says, quote, the plan speaks volumes about the real motives of this so-called family-friendly administration. He says cutting workers' pay to avoid overtime is illegal based on a 1945 Supreme Court ruling. But Labor Department Administrator Tammy McCutcheon disagrees. If changes were made week to week to avoid overtime, they would be illegal. She says, a one-time change is not. So, in other words, you screw people for a week or two, that's illegal. You screw them all year round and forever, that's just business. We had a lot of lawyers look at this rule, said McCutcheon. We would not have put that in there if we thought it was illegal, she said. Unless you have a contract, there is no legal rule prohibiting an employer from either raising your salary or cutting your salary. We do not anticipate employers will cut people's pay, she added. Well, Tammy, we did not anticipate Arabs flying airplanes into the World Trade Center, but they did, and now we're bankrupting the Treasury to prevent them from doing it again. 10 years ago, we did not anticipate Broadway theater tickets routinely topping $90 or $100, but then one producer did it, and now they all do it. All right, finishing up the AP article. The final plan does not require approval from Congress, which hasn't stopped Democrats and some Republicans from trying to block the rule, thus far unsuccessfully, out of fear that millions of workers would become ineligible for overtime. Department officials say about 644,000 higher-paid workers would lose their overtime eligibility, but the proposal says 1.5 million to 2.7 million workers will be more readily identified as exempt from overtime requirements. Labor unions claim the figure is closer to 8 million. Spokesman says the Labor Department has read tens of thousands of comments about the proposal and understands what the concerns are. And we're going to do our best to address them, she said. Uh-huh. It's important to allow us to finish that process so we can back up our words with some good faith action. Unquote. The end. Okay, my thoughts on all this. And I'm not sure if you were able to follow. I'm not sure I was. But first of all, I'm not sure why workers are being guaranteed overtime pay no matter what their wages are or their hours are. Imagine you hire a babysitter while you go off to the theater. You pay her $10 an hour and all the ice cream she can eat, figuring you'll be gone for 6 hours, from 6 to midnight. And you agree beforehand that if your train's late or you're stuck in traffic and you don't get back till 1 a.m., she'll make $20, double the basic rate for the extra hour of overtime. But if you get home at 11:30, half an hour early, it's not like she still gets the extra sawbuck. You should pay her for the full 6 hours agreed upon, but certainly no guarantee of the hour overtime. Now, if you hire the girl for 4 hours, from 6 to 10, knowing in the back of your mind that you're unlikely to get home much before midnight, then yes, the girl's entitled to 2 hours overtime pay, because it was your poor planning, your poor budgeting of time and money that created this overtime situation, which is how I feel about companies guaranteeing overtime. Hire enough people for enough hours to do the job, and you'll only use overtime when you really, really need it. I mean, I'm no economics expert, but I assume that's got to save some money down the line. And this is being pro-management. I'm not here to come off like some totally left-wing, pro-union, screw-the-bosses socialist with no understanding of what an employer has to put out week after week to keep a company running. If a company, a business, has to get a job done and needs to pay employees overtime over a certain period to do it, well, fine. And once you've paid an employee his weekly due, it's management's call to ask that worker to give more time in exchange for more money, and it should be the employee's call whether to say yes or no, once he's worked his full complement of regular hours. Now, personally, I feel if a company is spending tons of money on overtime, time and a half, double time pay, whatever it is, just means the company doesn't have enough regular full-time workers. Let's say you've got a company with 100 people working 40 hours a week, but you've really got them working 42 hours a week, everybody working an extra 2 hours at time and a half pay for those 2 hours. Now this adds an extra 200 work hours a week the company is paying for at time and a half. Well, it seems to me that company would save money and help the economy by hiring 5 more full-time people and pay them the regular wage. But of course, the other side of that, aside from some of the workers counting on overtime for a little extra cash or to make ends meet, is that adding full-time staff is never as simple as grabbing a chair and a desk, sitting them down and saying, okay, work. Aside from all the time and effort involved in the hiring process, there's insurance costs. If a company is covering all or part of its employees' health care costs, at this point, it's probably a damn sight cheaper to pay regulars overtime than to insure a lower-paid newbie. And aside from health costs, there's the expense of simply insuring the company against indemnity and occupational hazards. The more people in a company, I assume, the more the costs. And then there's just the practical side. A factory or business just might not have enough physical room for more employees unless they expand or move to another site. So it's fair for a company to both avoid overtime if it can, because of the extra payouts, and to use overtime when necessary to keep company size and payroll costs manageable, and to give loyal employees a way to make an extra few bucks now and then. But for the Labor Department to say management can slash its basic salaries and then just give the same workers overtime to make the same amount they would have made before is such a dangerous move. In a way, it not only does not guarantee overtime, it takes away the guarantee of a steady or rising wage. Which brings me to the second article I wanted to read, sort of on the same topic. This one is by Lenore Scanese, a columnist for the Daily News. She's like the sane version of Andrea Pizer, the right-wing nutjob on the New York Post. Scanese is smart, clear, humane, and she's cute too, but she knows what isn't cute, ordinary people struggling to get by. So last month, she wrote a column about it with a marvelous, very logical explanation of why we should stop beating ourselves up. It's kind of like what Barbara Ehrenreich did for the working class with her book, Nickeled and Dimed in America, Scanese's article summarizing a different book, one that shows how middle-class people are getting nickeled and dimed, or maybe quartered and half-dollared, to death. The column was called Cost Crunch is Killing the Middle Class, published on December 7th, which has its own rather dark irony. But here's the article. Scanese writes, drowning in debt, loathing yourself for spending $6 on a fancy sandwich, wondering how you ended up becoming exactly what your parents railed against, an overspending, self-indulgent, credit-sucking greed machine? Hey, me too. Then again, so are millions of American families. And the sort of good news is, it's not our fault. So says Elizabeth Warren, co-author of the terrifying new book, The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke. The problem, she says, is simple. The cost of being middle-class has jumped out of the reach of the middle-class. In just one generation, the price of a decent home, health insurance, and schooling has so outstripped the average paycheck that, incredibly, a family with two earners today ends up with less discretionary income than a family with one earner back in the 1970s. This explains why so many American families are going into debt. They can't afford the necessities. The situation has gotten so bad that American children are now more likely to see their parents file for bankruptcy than divorce. Oldsters may harumph that, well, in their day, families didn't spend money they didn't have. They didn't blow their bucks on Nikes and Nintendos. They didn't yada, yada, yada. But guess what? It is not the Nikes and Nintendos that are doing us in. Research shows that, adjusted for inflation, families today actually spend 21% less on clothing than they did a generation ago. They spend 22% less on food than they did. Not just at home, but including all the meals out. They even spend less on home appliances, except for computers. So it's not that we families are frittering away our fortunes. No, our fortunes are being frittered away for us. And while several major forces are at work, including the cost of health care and college, the most serious blame, Warren says, must go to bad schools and easy credit. Bad schools? Yeah, just a generation ago, most people thought their local public schools were fine. Today, well, you know what's up today, desperate families are willing to pay almost anything to live where the schools are good. This has driven up housing prices absurdly. Now, Lenore Scanese writes for the Daily News. This is her article. But she sure could be talking about Long Island. I mean, you know, how much extra do you pay a year to live in your school district? Anyway, Scanese continues. As middle-class families overextend themselves to pay for these hideously expensive, formerly reasonable homes, there's little cash left for everything else. That's where the easy credit comes in. Most credit cards promise great terms, 6% or 8% a year, but if you're late on a payment, even by an hour, that rate can soar to 30% with a whopping penalty. We'll pay $7 billion in late fees this year. Now, how did that slope become so slippery? Blame the change in banking laws. Until the 1970s, these laws set a ceiling on the interest and fees that credit card companies could charge. Then the laws were lifted, and lenders went trolling for customers, hoping they would borrow, slip up, and pay loads of interest. Turned out to be a good strategy because banking profits have grown $50 billion since 1970. That's where the middle class's money is. Now, what can we do to help that class get back on its feet? Now, remember here, I'm reading from Lenore Skenazy's article in the Daily News, and she says that, according to the Two Income Trap book, the solutions are obvious and hard. First, we have to improve all our schools so that families need not move to Scarsdale to get their kids a decent education. Then we have to bring back the usury laws to get credit card rates down. Problem is, we can't insist our politicians do any of this if, and this is the bit that fascinates me, this is, I think, the most liberating part of the article. We can't insist our politicians do anything if we are too embarrassed to mention our angst. So long as Americans can be persuaded that families in financial trouble have only themselves to blame, there will be no demand to change anything, writes Warren. So let's quit blaming ourselves, writes Skenazy, and start demanding some changes. End of article. Now, ordinarily, this is me again, Dave. I've grown tired of this blame-the-system attitude when it comes to crime or shoddy workmanship, the whole thing of Hector robbed the liquor store because his dad drank and his mom beat him and he had to join a gang to fit in, yada yada, poor Hector. The lack of means does not justify the end, and the shirking of personal responsibility has certainly contributed to a lot of the problems in our society. But people blaming themselves for things they're really not responsible for can be just as damaging, just as enervating. In a capitalist society, money is so important, not just to buy things, but the status of having money, that the absence of money causes a disturbance in the status quo. It's why middle classes, all classes, hang together. Middle class people feel out of place in rich people's houses. While at the same time, middle-class people have no trouble welcoming working-class folks and immigrants as maids and laborers, but not as neighbors and boyfriends. As Tevye put it in Fiddler on the Roof, it's no great shame to be poor, but it's no great honor either. But America has made it a shame to be poor, to not have enough money to put a roof over your head so you're forced out into the street. You become refuse, human leftovers that the system scrapes into the garbage. The homeless are ugly and scary because seeing them always forces us to calculate how many paychecks away, how many dead relatives away we are from being them. So people give them money out of pity, like feeding a stray cat, or they look away and ignore. There's always the occasional cruel sicko who likes to set fire to cats. But the anti-poverty bias starts young. In elementary school, at the playgrounds, children will pick on the kids with faded clothes, the ones with sneakers or that look a little unwashed, and then move it to the middle class level. There was an article in the New York Times last September about how all the kids from the tonier Long Island suburbs were preparing for the new school year, and it wasn't about their buying book covers and new corrective shoes and protractors. It was about their spending $2,000 or $3,000 on makeovers, tans, nail salons, hair treatments, fashionable clothing, 12-year-olds making sure that they had a look so they could be part of the in crowd, so that they look richer and more powerful than the kids who just went to a regular barber and a discount clothing store and a Kmart for supplies. And that's not just Long Island, that's any community anywhere. Not having sufficient money to fit in, or certainly to pay all your bills, in a capitalist society, that is viewed as a kind of crime. They can't throw you in debtor's prison, a la the Keynesian times, but you can certainly be ostracized, hounded by creditors, forced into bankruptcy, and made to feel that you're not worthy of being part of the society you're part of. And so this mindset, which on one level came to fruition during the 1950s and 60s, with manufacturing and wealth and creature comforts really taking over basic American life. If you had one car in your garage, you were okay. But if you had two cars in your garage, you were better. And if you had two garages, you could take a piss on everybody else's car. But the attitude started way before that. when Okies were forced out of the Dust Bowl to become itinerant laborers, and thus be treated like vagabond gypsies by homeowners, police, and bankers, when Irish or German or Polish or Italian or Jewish immigrants were crowded into mini ghettos, and the only way they could get out was to de-ethnicize themselves and make money. The poverty made their ethnicity ugly, not the other way around, as the Rothschilds proved. So the mindset is as old as the hills, but the variations keep presenting themselves in new ways. And the latest, as Lenore Skenazy points out, as Elizabeth Warren apparently wrote in her book, is that instead of demanding more from our politicians and the people who run our schools and banks and insurance companies and big businesses, instead of forcing them to concentrate on issues that will directly ease the average person's day-to-day financial burden, we let them distract us with preemptive wars and $100 million Hollywood movies and news about celebrity murder trials and a zillion commercials and billboards to make us feel even guiltier about not having as much as we want, as much as we are being forced to want. So the average person has to earn more per hour to pay the mortgage or the rent, to pay the health insurance, the private school tuition or public school taxes, to pay the monopolized utility bills. And the more he earns per hour, the more tempting it's going to be for his bosses to get Mexicans, Malaysians to work for $6 an hour, or $3 an hour if the factory is physically moved to Malaysia or Mexico. And when election time rolls around in November, and everybody's dithering about whether Iraq was a good idea, or whether the Patriot Act was overkill, or whether the stock market can go back up to 11,000, or whether the economic recovery is jobless, or whether men should be sent to Mars, I hope someone will ask the questions of whether we're better off exploring red dust on Mars or water decontamination on Earth. The question of whether new jobs that are being created actually pay all the bills. The question of whether retirement plans will stay the same no matter where the stock market zooms or plateaus, of whether people will be living under constant scrutiny and electronic surveillance, of whether the next generation of kids will be the first since the late 60s to be drafted. But there is a bright side, I guess. I've talked for nearly half an hour about these issues, trying to be fair and even-handed, though, as usual, I probably came across more on the left side than the right, and yet, amazingly enough, nobody's called the station to brand me as a stinking commie or a red lefty or a Jew agitator. Maybe this country has made a little bit of progress. Or is it that you've been waiting for your next paycheck to get your phones turned back on? Back after this. Look, the economy's tough. We all know that. Money's tight, things are slow, but business goes on. People still need to know what you do and how well you do it. There's promotion and word of mouth, but if you want to reach a broader market and really get the word out, you gotta advertise. And I suggest you advertise on Dave's Gone By. People listen all across Long Island and around the country on the internet, so if you have a product, event, or service to tell them about, you can buy a commercial or sponsor a whole segment of the show. Compared to print, the rates are unbelievably cheap, and you get lots of added value, and you link your professional name to a special program with a loyal audience. Advertising on Dave's Gone By is easy, cost-effective, and fun. So get a piece of the Dave. Call 516-295-1511, 295-1511, or email davesgoneby@aol.com. Start your economic recovery right now. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and AM 1240 WGBB.com on this Monday, January 19th, Martin Luther King Day. It's time for the News Gone By, a look at world and local events of the past week from an I'm OK, MLK perspective. We begin with the presidential campaign front, where Carol Moseley Braun has dropped out of the race, the first casualty since nine major candidates crowded the field months ago. She was the only woman in the Democratic race, and when she quit, she threw her support behind Howard Dean. When told that Moseley Braun was endorsing him, Dean said, "Who?" No, but even though her constituency was small, Mosley Braun's endorsement should take some of the sting out of Al Sharpton's recent criticism of Dean, accusing him of failing to appoint or assist minorities. Mosley Braun and Sharpton later had a long and constructive discussion in the parking lot. All the other candidates watched them from a distance, with Dennis Kucinich saying, "Some of my best friends look like those two." Dick Gephardt saying, "I wish I were taking part in that discussion, with a dozen news cameras coincidentally showing me taking part in that discussion." Joseph Lieberman said nothing, but he did run to his car and put a sign on the windshield reading, "No radio." In world news, a 22-year-old Palestinian woman, the mother of a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old, strolled to a crossing point on the Gaza Strip and blew herself up, killing 4 Israeli soldiers. According to Newsday, she made a farewell videotape before her little excursion. On it, she said, "God gave me 2 children. Only God knew how much I loved them." Unquote. Well, no. Everybody now knows how much you love them. Not nearly enough, you stupid bitch. In her video, she also said, quote, "It was always my wish to turn my body into deadly shrapnel against the Zionists and to knock on the doors of heaven with the skulls of Zionists," unquote. Well, gee, I guess she's in for a surprise when the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob sees her at the front gate holding Jewish skulls in a pastry box. Satan's just going to grab the tail of her headscarf and yank her straight down, let her stoke the fires of hell for a few centuries, and as for her family, well, hey, I'm all for reuniting her with her beloved children as soon as possible. Come on, kids, pick up a rock. Make our day. And speaking of children the world would be better off without, Ken Carney, Phil Sophia, and Thomas Diaspora received their sentences on Wednesday. These are the 3 defendants of the Mepham High School football sodomy case, and I use their names, Ken Carney, Phil Sophia, Thomas Diaspora, because their youth allowed them to duck the heaviest punishments. They were all tried as juveniles, so a little public shaming of their names is the least I can do. The oldest boy, Phil Sophia, will be sent to a juvenile boot camp for at least 4 months, which sounds kind of minor, although after seeing the movie Holes, I'll reserve judgment on whether that's so much better than prison. Of course, the great irony is that Phil Sophia is being sent to the kind of place where what he did to another boy is exactly what he needs to be most afraid of. But still, it's only 4 months, when he could have been put there till he turns 21, so he did catch a break. So did Ken Carney, the real sicko mastermind behind the whole thing. Because of his mile-long record of bizarre and aggressive incidents, he's being sent to a diagnostic center for counseling. And the third kid, Thomas Diaspora, he squealed on the other two, so he just gets supervised probation. The 3 perps also have to pay the victims' medical bills and write 1,500-word apology essays to their families. Those should be fun to read, huh? Here, let's listen to one right now. "Dear Mrs. Fitzgerald, I'm sorry for what I done to your son, Edmund. It's not his fault he's kind of a wuss, and I shouldn't have stuffed things up his butt like I did. If there were a way I could go back in time and take things out of his butthole instead of ramming them in, I would do that. Not a day goes by that I don't wish things were different. I can't look at a broom handle or see a pine cone lying on the grass without thinking of Edmund's poop chute. And if I called him a faggot or queer or a sissy boy, it's not because he is one, only because he screamed like one when the broom was sticking out of him. It's a subtle difference, but I think I understand it now. I can only hope that you find it in your heart to forgive me, and if you do, can I have my golf balls back? They were Max Fly and $2 apiece. Sincerely, Ken Carney." The story did play on News 12 and Newsday, and it filled up the old Nassau Herald. How kids from a school were so vicious and cruel to the rectum of Edmund Fitzgerald. The town of Belmore lies upon the south shore, on an affluent part of Long Island. They pay a high tax just to keep out the blacks, in the hopes that their kids won't grow violent. Now one such young boy was his mom's pride and joy, such a virile and athletic laddie. Like others his age, he thought sports the rage, and he tried to be just like his daddy. It felt like a dream when young Ed made the team as a junior varsity halfback. But some other players gave him arrogant stares. They became his continual laugh track. He played right along and he tried to be strong to show he had no trepidation. It gave him the creeps, but these were his peeps, and he longed for the team's validation. He managed all right until one summer night when the team went to North Pennsylvania. As silent as monks, they all rose from their bunks as if gripped by a furious mania. With nary a sound and no coaches around, the older kids pummeled the juvies. They guarded the door while the boys licked the floor and then squealed like the guy in the movies. Although that hurt some, there were worse things to come when the new guys were forced to get naked. The quarterback grinned, "Let the hazing begin. If you wanna be one of us, take it." The torture began all according to plan, with a rhythm like boom-chick-a-boom-chick. You better not howl or we'll puncture your bowel with a rubberized end of a broomstick. When that part was done, they continued the fun of pinecone and golf ball inserting. The cavities dripped as the soft tissue ripped, and the feces and blood began spurting. The victims were warned they'd be punished and scorned if they told any parents or teachers. But by the next game, they were still hurt and shamed. You could see the red stains from the bleachers. The season was stopped, and the scholarships dropped, and the town became crazed and divided. A few sent regrets, the others death threats, till lawyers and cops were provided. The rumors did spread from Rosedale to Riverhead, how a team went from scrimmage to Sodom. And poor Edmund cried when a splinter was pried from the extra-large width of his bottom. So now there's a judge who will go through the sludge of how innocent boys were imperiled. The legend will spread like the legs of poor Ed, and the rectum of Edmund Fitzgerald, the rectum of Edmund Fitzgerald. Welcome back to the News Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and AM 1240 WGBB.com on this winter evening in January. Been cold enough for you? Certainly was for 86-year-old Esther Wallace, described by the Daily News as a plucky Brooklyn grandmother. Wallace woke up early in her apartment last Sunday, felt chilly, and went to turn up the thermostat. She couldn't see it, so she lit a candle. Unbeknownst to her, and no one knows how this came to be, but instead of a candle, she accidentally lit an M80. The resulting explosion shattered dishes, set off car alarms, and tore chunks of skin off the woman's face and hands. Otherwise, remarkably, she's fine. She's undergoing skin grafts and says, quote, "I'm a strong person, I have to live for another few years," unquote. She also said she was actually quite lucky, because she usually reaches for a candle when she needs to scratch her hemorrhoids. No, but seriously, she said the episode did make her kind of nostalgic. It's the first time she's had a finger bang since 1962. Well, Ms. Wallace was lucky in another respect, in that she didn't have Dr. Harold Shipman as her MD. In the ultimate example of physician heal thyself, Britain's Dr. Death hung himself last week. Kind of an ironic joke right there, but wait, there's more. Harold Shipman was responsible for over 200 patient murders by heroin injection. Prosecutors said his drive to kill was fueled by having a godlike power over life and death. So, He played God by tying some bedsheets together and making a homemade noose in his jail cell. What gets me is how this guy could, over a 30-year period, wipe out more people than a plane crash. The beauty part is that his second year practicing medicine, 1975, he admitted he was addicted to painkillers. And the year after that, now I'm not making this up, he was fined for 82 separate drug offenses, but still allowed to continue practicing medicine. Fellow doctors only became concerned when they noticed just how many death certificates Dr. Shipman was asking them to countersign. They also became suspicious when they found fan letters from women asking him to be their family physician. Those signatures included Nancy Reagan, Dana Reeve, and Anna Nicole Smith. Speaking of medicine, it's not really a news item, but have you seen the ubiquitous TV commercials for Zoloft? It's a prescription drug, an antidepressant, that corrects a chemical imbalance in the brain. And the commercial shows that cute little animated Olive, he's shuffling along under a rain cloud, feeling blue, and then after Zoloft, he can smile again. And the voice over says the side effects of this drug may include, quote, upset stomach, dry mouth, diarrhea, sexual side effects, feeling sleepy or tired, tremor, indigestion, sweating, feeling agitated, and decreased appetite. And then right after that, they say, Zoloft is not habit-forming. Well, no, I don't imagine it would be. A day after you stop taking it, I question whether a patient would say, you know, I really miss that dry mouth feeling I used to enjoy with Zoloft. My mouth feels too wet most of the time. I crave the drying effects of a good Zoloft. Habit forming? After a couple of those side effects, you'd have to pay me to take that stuff again. It's like saying, if you jam a steak knife in your left eye, possible side effects are bleeding, nausea, blindness, dizziness in your right eye, constipation, and death. Stabbing yourself in the eye is not habit forming. Oh, and by the way, not to pick on Zoloft or anything, but they may have made a misnomer. If you are taking a medicine that leaves you agitated, tired, sleepy, and impotent, I think the word for that is not antidepressant, but depressant. If I have a rectal itch and I smear a soothing ointment on the region and it starts to burn and give me a rash, that no longer qualifies as a soothing ointment. That has now become a fire ointment. That becomes a get-this-out-of-my-ass-before-I-start-crapping-blood ointment. Oh, sure, that's tough to fit that on this side of the box, but truth in advertising, folks, really. And speaking of marketing, Portland-based McTarnahan's Brewing Company has come out with a new beer labeled after the new governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's a full-bodied ale called the Governator, and shows a muscle man flexing on the label. Not surprisingly, the beer has a high alcohol content and many of the characteristics of the famous movie star. When men drink it, they turn thick-tongued and stupid, and on women, it goes right to their ass. And while we're on the subject of rear ends, fans of heavy metal might want to visit Joe's Pub, the cabaret venue that's part of the Public Theater in New York City on February 11th. It's the first New York appearance of a punk band from Bremen, Germany called Pink Steel. I haven't heard them, but no joke, the band members are apparently gay, and they inject homosexual perspective and attitudes into their music and their act. The Village Voice voted Pink Steel the best gay heavy metal band of 2003. Granted, their only competition was Judas Priest, but still, among the songs that Pink Steel will perform are I'm Coming Out, All Over You, and the pro-chicken anthem We Fight for Cock. Now the band's slogan, I'm not making any of this up, slogan is gay heavy metal at its hardest, pun intended, and the press release for the group's appearance at Joe's Pub reads, and this is a quote, the songs and stories take heavy metal's bluster and spandex, reverse the gender preference, and presto, fist-pumping audiences of all shapes and tastes, unquote. Of course, the difference between regular and gay heavy metal is that in gay heavy metal, half the audience members pump their fists into the other half. In commerce news, although over the years America has had a prickly relationship with France, for their haughty manners, for their early surrender in World War II, for their refusal to help us in Iraq, but business is business. And last week, Paris got its first Starbucks. At last, revenge! Another food chain threw a birthday party last week for Ruby Fontaine of Topeka, Kansas. Ruby got the special treatment because this 80-year-old woman has eaten the exact same lunch every single day for the past 15 years. Is it yogurt? Tofu? Macrobiotic salad? No. Every day, sometimes twice a day, Ruby Fontaine visits Taco Bell and orders two tacos, no hot sauce, but lots of sour cream and beans. In fact, she has the employees cut off the top part of the taco so she can get to the good stuff that much quicker. Laugh if you wish, but it's the same logic lesbians use when they shave. No, anyway, at the birthday party, employees gave Ruby a cake and some presents. She tried to give them a hug, but no one would go near her, with one overheard to shout, "For God's sakes, don't light any candles." Well, Mama, don't you take my Kodachrome away, but they will, because in technology news, time marches on and tramples history with it. The Eastman Kodak Company, founded in 1888 by George Eastman, will stop making and selling film cameras next year. Yes, they'll make a lot more digital cameras, and they'll do a lot more high-end work for medical imaging and printing. And they will keep making those popular one-shot cameras, but the old-fashioned film camera is on the way out, as are slide projectors. And the interesting thing is that they're going to keep making film. There won't be any cameras to put it in, but film will be plentiful, and the company says that in the years to come, Americans should be prepared to see the overall demise of film cameras, the liquidation of film stock, and a proliferation of Japanese tourists wandering around with sketch pads and crayons. Some animal news. In Groningen, Holland, a trainer has come up with a unique way to bond dog owners and their pets. Annette Helder is giving doggy dancing lessons. That's right. According to Reuters, 10 owners and their dogs have signed up to waltz, tango, and boogie together. The dogs include a border collie and German shepherd. Helder charges 45 euros for the service. That's about 60 bucks for 8 lessons. Very reasonable. And she says, quote, "Dogs love when they get attention from their owners. You teach the dog certain basic moves, like weaving between your legs, circling, walking backwards, and rolling over," unquote. Ultimately, the dog and the owner learn to move in time to music. Snicker if you wish, but this has been a competitive sport since 2001. It was developed in the United States and Great Britain. Now, the first official competition of what they call canine freestyle was held in Belgium in March 2001. For those who are interested, the sport is apparently governed in this country by two organizations with two different styles, kind of like wrestling has, the Canine Freestyle Federation, the CFF, and the World Canine Freestyle Organization. Now, the CFF concentrates on dog movements and dog skills. The WCFO focuses more on the relationship between dog and handler and the costumes worn by both. I am not making this up. And the third organization, the most recent one, is the Musical Dog Sport Association, and it has a more gestalt approach when it all comes together, training, teamwork, music, and creativity. Now, I may sound a little cynical about all this, but I think it's wonderful, silly fun, and I love dogs, but I think they got it backwards. They're putting all this effort and emphasis into the trainer teaching the dog to do pointless tricks. Meanwhile, a dog can poop without wiping, scare burglars just by growling, and contentedly eat the same dry meal 3 times a day, every day, for life. I think dogs should be teaching us this useful stuff instead of the other way around. And don't forget, as Triumph the Insult Comic Dog pointing out in his recent single, dogs can lick their own balls. Screw teaching them to roll over. Let them teach us to roll under. And really, no joke, my wife will vouch for this. One of our dogs, a small dachshund who was neutered 1.5 years ago, achieves sexual gratification by licking his own penis. He licks it, gets it big, he has an orgasm all by himself. Cringe if you want to, but I'm so proud of him for developing that skill, because, you know, I must have licked his penis 100 times and never brought him to climax. Did I mention this show is DGB-13? Yeah. But as long as I'm on the subject of sex, let's go to the videotape and the troubles of an adult video and novelty store in Valley Stream. Unwanted by the community since it first opened in 1994, Hempstead Video tried its best to comply with town ordinances, though occasionally cleaving to the letter of the law rather than the spirit. Still, it's the town that was fighting dirty, no pun intended. After the store opened up on the corner of Sunrise Highway and Rockaway Avenue, the village passed laws that no such establishment could operate so close to a school, church, or residential neighborhood. Then they tried to shut the place down based on these new laws. Hempstead Video cried free speech, and the two sides settled out of court back in 1996. But at the time, the store promised not to have enclosed viewing booths. Well, according to Newsday, sometime last year the village learned, and I wonder how they learned this, that six booths were built, with lockable doors and all-important paper towel dispensers. Hempstead Video argued that because the booths had 18 inches of open space at their tops, they weren't really enclosed. Yeah, good one, guys. Well, the store eventually took away the doors, but then they were already in hot water. Valley Stream Village attorney Michael McKenna told the press, quote, "Code enforcement has already served the first summons and will continue to serve more until the business ceases operation or relocates," unquote. I don't know, you think they're picking on this place just for breaking that rule? Somehow, I don't think a bakery that gets the occasional roach or rat turd engenders that kind of response. I don't think the hardware store that sells a couple of defective lawn sprinklers goes under that level of scrutiny. But hey, if a town wants to hound you out of business, and they do it legally, I guess it's better than burning you down. Still, I never understood this ordinance thing of not building something too close to this or 300 feet from that. I'm not talking about power lines or nuclear plants. I just mean a legal place of business having to be X amount of yards from a school and Y amount of square cubits from a church. I mean, okay, I guess nobody wants to live right next door to a punk nightclub or a biker bar, but in a commercial district? If a bar opens on the same block as a high school, but the bartender is forbidden by law to serve any kid without proof that he's 21 years old, if that bartender obeys the law, it doesn't matter if there are 100 schools in a half-mile radius. The children have to walk on by. If the bartender doesn't follow the rules, if he doesn't card the minors, then you shut him down, you force him out of business. Same with a video store. If the sign says, under 18, not admitted, and you find 16-year-olds in the paper towel rooms, get out your padlocks. But otherwise, the school and the store should be able to coexist. Is the assumption that kids are illiterate and can't read the giant adults-only sign? Or that they're so dumb, they'll wander into a dildo shop instead of a pizza parlor by mistake? I'll tell you something. If you build a diner right next to a hospital, how many people are going to walk into the emergency room and ask for an omelet? And how many people strolling down the street are going to sit down at the diner and demand eye surgery? I'm not talking about a Polish neighborhood, I'm talking about... No, just kidding. But strange as this may seem, I do believe that people, even young people, are savvy enough that when they need medical attention, they'll visit the hospital. And when they need lunch, they'll choose the diner. And in all my years living on the South Shore of Nassau County and visiting the Sunrise Mall and shopping in Valley Stream, I've never accidentally walked in to the Hempstead Video Store thinking it was a Chinese restaurant. I never sat in the enclosed booth under the mistaken impression that I was at the Department of Motor Vehicles watching a training film. I never cleaned disgusting stains off my pants while believing I was ice skating at the hockey rink. I never paid the owner's daughter to take my pants down and sodomize me anally with a Dr. Pepper bottle and then told my wife I was buying a television at the Wiz. I never walked out with a bag full of strap-ons, Benoit balls, and penis extenders, imagining I was eating ribs at Dallas Barbecue. I never... What? Oh. The engineer says my wife called, and just a second, folks.
What?
My wife said what? Okay, folks, if anybody has a place where I can sleep tonight, please call the station at 631-888-8811, 631-888-8811. Meanwhile, I'll get back to the news. Time for an animal story. Rita Beaulieu is a 76-year-old woman living on a fixed income in central Islip, Long Island. For company, instead of a dozen cats or a minor bird, Rita has her pet rooster, Roosty, who has landed her in court 3 times owing to complaints by her next-door neighbor. It seems Roosty, being a rooster, wakes up at 4:30 in the morning and then sets about waking up everyone else. Finally, the neighbor got so exasperated, he signed an affidavit, and since then, Beaulieu has been 3 times before a judge, refusing to pay the $25 fine. She says no other neighbor has ever complained, and the one who is was fighting with her family long before she ever had Roosty. I asked the neighbor why he was causing so much trouble over the natural occurrence of a crowing rooster. He replied, "Listen, buddy, if I'm going to be woken up at 4:30 in the morning by a cock, and you know, folks, I'm not even going to finish that joke. I'm just going to ring the comedy bell." Yes, my trusty comedy bell, signaling that Dave's gone by bad pun of the week. Every week we make a play on words, or this week we nearly make a play on words, so chicken-hearted, so reprehensible, that we have to crow about it with the comedy bell. Oh, sure, we could make the joke without the comedy bell. We could say the pun, make the play on words, giggle, 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 groan, 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 and then just move on to the next item. But would I do that to you? Of course not. I have to make you sit through a sales pitch first. And that sales pitch is to advertise your product, event, or service in conjunction with this segment. Or pick another segment. Dave Goes Off, The World Weird Web, Dave's Gone Cultural, Dave's Got Guests. If you have money, we have a segment. If you call me or email me and say, "Hey, Dave, I have a pile of money. Can you do a segment about piles of money?" I would say, "Sure I would, kind sir," and then by gum, I would do it. No, wait, I wouldn't do it that way. First, I'd take the money, and then I'd say, "Sure I would, kind sir," and then by Jove, I would do it. No, wait, no, I would take it, I'd count it, I'd deposit it in an offshore Swiss account, spend the weekend in the Bahamas with 2 absolutely amazing and double-jointed hookers, and then I would do it. But it would be a hell of a segment, wouldn't it? But I hear you out there saying, "Dave, that's bribery, that's graft, that's payola." And I say unto thee, "You're damn right it is, and thank God for it. This isn't 1950, and I'm not Alan Freed. I'm not even Alan Thicke. This is 2004, I'm on WGBB, I have a wife, 2 dogs, and a mescaline habit I can't kick. Feed my need." That's the catchphrase of the week. Feed my need. Bring me piles and piles of money, and you can't imagine the feces I would eat to get my hands on your dough. Do you have a restaurant so disgusting the health inspectors slipped on their own vomit running out the back door? I'll advertise it. Give me the money. Are you a cab driver from Fadukistan using all your extra cash to buy weapons for your government? Sponsor one of my segments and reach fanatical gun owners all over Long Island. If you've got the money, honey, I've got the time. Prime time every week on this radio program, both on the air, on WGBB AM 1240, and on the internet at am1240wgbb.com. Don't forget that. If you're a priest in a local diocese and parents won't let their children near you because you still have semen stains on your cassock, no problem. Give me the money. Advertise here and reach sweet young boys and girls from India to Zambia and Timbuktu, too. There's no morality here, only money. That's why this is America. And that's why you should advertise on Dave's Gone By. 30-second ads, 60 seconds, 90 seconds, they're all available. They're all dirt cheap. The dirt I grovel in for you, for your precious and valued and heartfelt money. Remember, too, that advertising on Dave's Gone By works on three principles: repetition, humor, and repetition. And it helps us reach thousands of listeners, every week with your lies, your exaggerations, your distortions. And if you just so happen to have a really good product or service at a reasonable price that people would probably like, hey, it happens. Nobody's perfect. So put your money where my mouth is and advertise on Dave's Gone By. Call 516-295-1511 for all the details. 516-295-1511. And don't forget, we can include your link on our website and mention you in our weekly emails to loyal listeners. Don't miss out on this opportunity. 516-295-1511 or email davesgoneby@aol.com. davesgoneby@aol.com to sponsor the Dave's Gone By Bad Pun of the Week. Don't be good, be ponderful. In media news, Jed Petrick is stepping down after 9 years running the WB11 television network. Petrick says he's resigning to pursue other opportunities, but he'll be long remembered for bringing to the WB network such hit shows as, I had a list. It's Channel 11, the one between Weather and News 12. Well, anyway, best of luck, Jed. Your legacy will not be forgotten. In theater news, the predictions were right. Taboo is closing. The Broadway musical by and about pop star Boy George was just losing too much money week after week, so producer Rosie O'Donnell's biting the bullet and pulling the plug. Although audiences seem to like Taboo, the critics were harsh, and the show will close millions of dollars in the red on February 8th. Asked why she was waiting till then, O'Donnell said that's how long it'll take Boy George to get off all his makeup if he starts right now. Also in theater news, the closing of another show, a one-man show starring Ben Gazzara called Nobody Don't Like Yogi, about baseball great Yogi Berra. Well, nobody didn't really hate it, but not much people or critics really liked it either. Yogi Berra could even improve upon the grammar of that statement. But anyway, a while ago I had written a song about Ben Gazzara when he had seemed to disappear from the movie scene. He was a big star for a decade or two, and then maybe he was doing a lot of movies outside of this country, but he seemed to go away and not be seen as much. And now he's been doing a lot more, and of course he's been off-Broadway for a couple of months until yesterday when his off-Broadway show closed. So now, finally, it is once again appropriate to play this little ode, this little ditty, this little tribute to the man and the star, Ben Gazzara. Oh, how I miss Ben Gazzara. What an actor, what a talent, what a star. Why did he give up on the business? Is he hiding on an island or an isthmus? Will there be no studio release for Christmas? Oh, how I miss Ben Gazzara. What an actor, what a talent, what a star. You can't go so long without practice and still be one of the great method actors. That's why I miss Ben Gazzara. Although his script choices were terrible, he made Cassavetes' films bearable. Even Shimada was better than nada. Oh, how I miss Ben Gazzara. What an actor, what a talent, what a star. I'd rather watch Killing of a Chinese Bookie then take a week off from work playing hooky, eat a double fudge-covered graham cracker cream center chocolate chip cookie, or have Dallas Cowgirl cheerleader shower room baby oil nookie. Oh, how I miss Ben Gazzara. What an actor, what a talent, what a star. Is he off in a room playing Pac-Man while his roles all go to Gene Hackman? Oh, how I miss Ben Gazzara. What an actor, what a talent, what a star. How I wonder where you are. And speaking of celebrities, hard rocker Ted Nugent suffered a mishap on the set of his reality show. He lost control of a chainsaw, which sliced through his leg, leaving a gash that required 20 stitches. Witnesses say the creepiest part was not watching Nugent shriek in pain, but seeing a whole herd of deer gather nearby, pointing, giggling, and sharpening their teeth. And speaking of dismemberment, in sporting news, 13-year-old Bethany Hamilton placed fifth in her age group at a surfing competition in Hawaii. This was no small accomplishment, since last year, Hamilton lost her left arm in a shark attack. I guess she's all right now. And finally, in war news, it's official! The death count for American soldiers in Iraq has reached 500. Collect them all! Each one is personally inspected by Donald Rumsfeld and suitable for burying. Of course, we can never guarantee their value will increase, especially if more and more of them saturate the market. And it's true that by government standards, they're only worth a few million barrels of oil. But their sentimental value, especially to the original owners, is basically priceless. And that's the news gone by for January 19th, 2004. And there are a lot of people I'm very lucky to have in my life as I approach my 40th birthday this coming Friday. Certainly my parents, my family, my in-laws, my good friends and colleagues over the years. I saw a bunch of them yesterday at my surprise birthday party. Yay! My wife totally pulled it off with a little help from my folks and relatives. It was a terrific time. I'll talk more about it next week and hopefully play some audio excerpts from it. They even did a short play based on a trip I took a few years ago that really knocked me out. So I'll definitely be doing birthday highlights next week, I know that. And I also know it would be pretty lonely turning 40 all on my own. So having dozens of friends, family, and acquaintances I'm in touch with, not just one day out of 365, but all year long, that's about as good a birthday present as anybody could wish for. I wish engineer Joe Salzone could have made it to the party. He was invited, but he had to be here to do his shift. But he did the next best thing. He put me on TV. His cable television show, Your World, yesterday afternoon, just before my party. Total coincidence that it fell out on the same day. It was a recording of the radio show we did together 2 weeks ago, taped for TV. So I hope you got a chance to see it. Looked like I hadn't slept in 3 weeks. I had bags under my eyes that could have been made by Samsonite, but still, the conversation was great. And there's a picture of Joe and me on my website taken that day, so check it out, hometown.aol.com/Dave's Gone By. If you forget that URL, just Google search Dave's Gone By, and I'm there. I think they repeat episodes of Joe's TV show now and again, so you might get another chance to catch it in the weeks ahead. I thought it was a lot of fun. And it's Your World with Joe Salzone, Sundays at 6 on the radio. Another show, Sunday nights at 11. He's on Monday nights at 11, so stay tuned tonight for that. He's also got the TV show, Long Island Cable Channel 20, Sunday afternoons at 1. And you can always hear him Monday nights at 6, just before my show, Dave's Gone By, starts at 6:30. Other thank yous. Bonnie D. Graham, host of Long Island's Dating, Friday nights at 6. Mark Torres and the gang at Comic Book Novice, Thursday nights at 9. Big thank you to the Tondor Grill, Indian cuisine, conveniently located at 222 Sunrise Highway in Rockville Center. See their full menu at tondorgrill.com. Not tandoori, tandoor. Leave off the last I for Indialicious. And I'll slave a slice of birthday cake for all of you out there listening, because you make this radio show, which is a big and delightful part of my life, worth all the time and effort and joy I put into it. And the icing on that birthday cake is hearing from you directly. So please, if you want to say hi, or complain, or suggest, or wish me 120 more, drop me an email at davesgongby@aol.com or snail mail a birthday card to Dave's Gone By, Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557. That's Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557. We reserve the right to read your letters on the air, name withheld upon request. And for those of you who do write in and do tell me or the station that you like the show, thank you very, very much. A belated or early happy birthday to all of you, depending on when your special day is. And with all the gratitude I'm expressing, I still have to give the vast majority thereof to my wonderful wife, Joyce, who's just been making these days leading up to my birthday so fun and so sweet and so happy. So that's the song, babe. Though I know I'll never lose affection for people and things that went before, I know I'll often stop and think about them, but in my life, I love you more.